Thank you. So this is a paper that appeared in February. And the idea is that inspired by deep brain models, we ask ourselves, if we live on a D3 brain in a closed string background, what does the D3 brain see? So we have the bosonic word volume degrees of freedom are the collective coordinates and the gauge field. And these are described by the Dirac-Bornfeld and Wetsumino action. The fermionic degrees of freedom are described by this fermionic coordinate. And we have the supersymmetrized version of the Dirac-Bornfeld and Wetsumino action. But this is written in superspace. So what we want to see is in ordinary space, what are the couplings between these fermions and the background? What are the dipole moments, the quadrupole moments, octuple moments? So we find these couplings to second order in theta, so we just find the dipole moments, and to first order in the field strength. And this was done for the D0 brain to linear order in the background fields by Miller, Taylor, and Ramstock, and we will follow more or less the same procedure, but we will do it exact in the background fields, and we will check that the T-duality of this result gives the D0 brain result. So the bosonic degrees of freedom are described by one excitation above the NS vacuum, or one orthogonal excitation or one parallel excitation above the NS vacuum. This gives us the coordinates and the gauge field. And the fermionic degrees of freedom is the Ramon vacuum, which forms a Majorana-Weyl spinor in 10 dimensions. And the setup that we have is the first setup that is interesting for phenomenology. It's a D3 brain in the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions where we keep Lorentz invariants. And we have 6 orthogonal dimensions that in some complex manifold M with some metric here. And we have a 5-form field that is self-dual and is the 4-form gauge field. It's a function of the orthogonal coordinates. So XM are the orthogonal coordinates times the epsilon tensor in 0, 1, 2, 3. And we will add to this 3-form field flux that is orthogonal to the brain and depends only on the coordinates orthogonal to the brain. And we will combine it. We will combine the NSNS and Ramon-Ramon form flux into this form. And we'll have a dilaton that changes also in the orthogonal direction. So this setup preserves Lorentz invariants. And just from 10-dimensional covariance and gauge invariants, we can know what the possible couplings are. So the fermions have to couple to the field strength and not the gauge fields to preserve gauge invariance. And the couplings could be of this form, where we contract all the indices with G, with tau, well, the derivative of tau, and with the 5-form field strength. But the fact that theta is a Majorana-Weyl spinor means that these are non-zero only if we have 3 gamma matrices here, or 7, which is the dual to this. So these couplings, these 2 couplings are ruled out. So from a direct coupling like this, the only coupling that we expect is a coupling to the 3-form flux. And in fact, we will see that this is what happens. So how do we find the coupling? We'll find it from the supersymmetric D-brain action. So this is a regular bosonic D-brain action, D3 brain action in the string frame. And this describes the massless bosonic degrees of freedom on the D-brain. The bosonic and fermionic word volume degrees of freedom are described by the supersymmetrized version of this that is exactly the same as this, but now these fields live in superspace. So these are all superfields. And this was developed by Aganagi, Popescu, and Schwartz in flat space, and then in curved space by Cederwald, Bongucci, Nielsen, Sandel, and Westerberg, and Bereshev. So the idea is that the fields live in superspace, and superspace is labeled by a bosonic coordinate and a fermionic coordinates. And the word volume is bosonic, but target space is superspace. These theta are 2 Majorana-Weyl spinors. In the 2A case, they have opposite chirality, and in the 2B case, they have the same chirality. And we call them theta 1 and theta 2. And this action has some local kappa symmetry, it has a symmetry of this type, where the fermions change proportional to this parameter kappa. And this 1 plus gamma is a projection. This gamma is a matrix that is traceless and squares to 1, so it has rank 16. So 1 plus gamma is a projector. And this gamma is a function of the fields on the brain. For example, for a D3 brain, this gamma looks like this. It's like 1 over the inverse of the DBI action times a term that is independent of the field strength, a term that is linear on the field strength, and a term that is quadratic on the field strength. And these matrices that appear here, sigma 1 and I sigma 2, are polymatrices that act on this SO2 space, kappa 1, kappa 2, or theta 1, theta 2. So this symmetry means that 16 of the Ware volume fermions can be projected out by a gauge choice. And some miracle happens that when we choose static gauge, these theta that were space-time fermions now are Ware volume fermions. So after choosing static gauge, we have the 16 surviving theta are the Ware volume degrees of freedom. So how do we find this coupling? So we have, for example, the Dirac-Bonifield, the super Dirac-Bonifield action looks like this, where all these fields are Ware volume fields and are a projection of the space-time super fields. And these indices are both fermionic and bosonic. So if we split them into bosonic, we get this, one bosonic and one fermionic, we get this, and two fermionic indices. And we do the same with every field. Gij is also a projection. Now the superfields are the Biellwine, so through the Biellwine we project the eta tensor onto superspace, and then with this onto the Ware volume. And we see that you want the action to second order in theta, and that's what we want. All the fields that have all bosonic indices, we need them to second order because this is zeroth order. With one fermionic index, we need them to first order. And with two fermionic indices, we need them to zeroth order. And the method that we'll use is called gauge completion. And this was developed by DeWitt, Peters, and Plefka for 11-dimensional supergravity, and was used by Miller, Taylor, and Van Ramstok for 2A, and was used by us for 2B. And the idea, I'll try to be very brief with this, but just give you an idea how this gauge completion works. The idea is to zeroth order, there's always a gauge where we can choose the Biellwine and the fields like this. So with all bosonic indices, the super fields are equal to the regular bosonic fields. This Biellwine with one bosonic and one fermionic is equal to the gravitino. This is zero, and this is the delta. And then all fields here, or all gauge fields with one fermionic index, they are equal to zero, to zeroth order. And everything, so the whole gauge completion lies in these two sentences. So a supersymmetric transformation of a superfield with parameter epsilon has to arise in superspace as a combination of a superspace diffeomorphism with this parameter, plus a Lorentz transformation if we are talking about the super Biellwine, or a gauge transformation if we are talking about the gauge field. And the idea is that if we do a supersymmetric transformation to a superfield, and we compute the theta equals to zero component, this should be equal to the supersymmetry transformation of the corresponding bosonic field. So this is a key equation, and through this we can find order by order all the fields. And I give you just one example. I promise this is the only ugly transparency with indices all around. So for example, if we do a supersymmetry transformation on the RR two-form field, we get this should arise as a superspace diffeomorphism that gives us these two terms, plus a super gauge transformation. And to zeroth order, the parameter of the gauge transformation with a bosonic index has to be equal to a regular bosonic diffeomorphism. With a fermionic index, it has to be equal to the supersymmetry. And for the super gauge transformation with a bosonic index is equal to the regular bosonic gauge transformation and with a fermionic index equal to zero. So for example, let's see how it works on the superdilaton because it's easier, we don't have many indices. So a supersymmetric transformation on the superdilaton should arise as a superspace diffeomorphism, and we only have this term because this term is zero for this case and we don't have a gauge transformation. And if we split this into fermionic and bosonic indices, this involves a regular diffeomorphism, so we should set that to zero too. And so what we say is that a supersymmetric transformation on a superdilaton should be equal to the supersymmetric transformation of the regular dilaton, which is equal to epsilon bar lambda. So from making this equal to this, we get the first order superdilaton, which is proportional to the dilatino. And so we will see, so we will work with a bosonic background, and for a bosonic background, we will get that the fields with all bosonic indices have only even components. So this first order component will be zero for a bosonic background, but the dilaton will have a second order component. And if we want to find a field with a fermionic index, it works the same, but there's a subtlety. So we perform a supersymmetry transformation on this superfield. So this should arise as a super diffeomorphism plus a gauge transformation. So again, we split this into bosonic and fermionic indices. When this has a bosonic index, it's proportional to this regular diffeomorphism that we don't care. And the lowest order terms are these, where we have a derivative with respect to theta of this sigma and a derivative with respect to theta of this lambda. So we need these parameters, the super diffeomorphism parameter and the super gauge parameter, to first order. And the way to find that, we made this equal to zero, so we get that the first order component of Cm mu will be equal to this. And so the last thing, I'll tell you how to find this out to first order, and then we have everything to find everything to second order. So to find this super diffeomorphism to first order, what we do is we perform a commutator of two supersymmetries on the super dilaton. And from closure of the algebra, this should be a super diffeomorphism, where the parameter depends on epsilon 1 and epsilon 2. And it depends on epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 in this way. And again, we split this into fermionic and bosonic indices. And this, the alpha phi, is proportional to the dilatino, so this will give zero in a bosonic background. And this sigma m epsilon 1 epsilon 2 from here is equal to this, plus a term that involves the diffeomorphism that we don't care. So, again, we say that it's commutator of two supersymmetries on the superfield, where at zeroth order in theta and zeroth order and zero making this equal to zero, should be equal to a regular commutator of two supersymmetries on the dilaton field, which is equal to this. So making this equal to this, we find the first order super diffeomorphism, which is something like this. So that's how everything works. To find the super gauge parameter to first order, we do the same. We apply the commutator of two supersymmetries to a gauge field. So that's all I'm going to say about how the calculation works. I mean, it's somewhat mechanical to get all the expansions. And to get expansion to second order, we proceed in the same way. And now we want to gauge fix the kappa symmetry. So we want to choose a word volume spinor such that the theta 1 is proportional to this spinor and theta 2 is proportional to this spinor. This is what was done for the D9 brain calculation, for the D9 brain action, and this is what we did. And this A and B are some numbers such that A squared plus B squared is equal to 1. And in Naganagi, Popescu, and Schwartz, in gauge invariant and gauge fixed actions, the choices are this AB equal to 1, 0, or 0, 1. So they just set one of these theta to 0. And in this paper, Taylor and Van Ramsok, they needed something like this, A equal to B. Like here we will leave A and B general and we will see some nice result that the result doesn't depend on A and B, which is what should happen, but it's not clear a priori that that's what we're going to get if we see the expansions. So I just wrote here the expansion of a couple of fields for you to see that the super dilaton is equal to the dilaton to zeroth order. The first order we say was zero for a bosonic background. And the second order is proportional to the three-form flux, the NSNS with some combination of A and B, A squared minus B squared, and the Ramon-Ramon with this product A times B. The super BL line is equal to the regular BL line plus the gauge, the spin connection, plus some combination of H3 and F3 and et cetera. So now we have all the expansions of the fields. And we want to insert them into the action, and we use expansion of the square root of the determinant. And what we get is that the action is something like this. So we have the regular kinetic term for the fermions, a coupling to the three-form flux, and the coupling is just to the three-form flux. It's of the form, of this form, and I'm going to talk about. And then coupling to the field strength couples to the derivative of the dilaton axion. So as we said, there's no coupling to F5 in this case, so the work volume fermions don't see the five-form flux. The warping of space just sets an overall scale here. It doesn't appear at all after that. The work volume gauge field couples to the derivative of the dilaton axion. And then there is a coupling to this combination. And I'm going to talk about this combination for a while because it's not a coincidence. It's a very particular combination. And what we can see is that the D3 brain has dipole moments of higher dimensional brain. So it has magnetic H dipole moment and magnetic D5 brain dipole moment. For example, if we have a coupling of this form, this would tell us that a D3 brain creates a two-form field, a two-form gauge field at long distances that is like that. So it's not like it's just one D3 brain that creates a two-form. It's not a group of D3 brains having higher dimensional brain charge, but it's one D3 brain in some polarizations create this field. And all the fields for a D0 brain were worked out by Miller, Taylor, and Ramstock in this paper for the D0 brain. We didn't do that for the D3 brain. And well, as I say, I'm not going to say, but we checked that this result has a correct duality transformation to give us a D0 brain result. And now I'm going to show you this gauge, what happens when we change the gauge to fix the kappa symmetry, and what happens with SL2R transformations. So we first go to the Einstein frame, and the coupling to C3 on the Einstein frame looks like this. And a gauge transformation means changing A and B into some A prime, B prime, but they square to 1, so A prime plus IB prime square is some phase with respect to A plus B, so we get a phase here. And an SL2R transformation where tau goes to A tau plus B over C tau plus D changes this combination e to the phi over 2 times C3 into the same combination times a phase, where this phase is a phase of C tau plus D. And so any one of these two phases can be removed by a chirality rotation on the spinors. So if we do a chirality rotation on the spinors, this thing here gets transformed into this. So theta, this product, theta prime gamma pqr theta, goes to theta gamma pqr theta, times a phase. So by this phase, you can remove any of these two phases. So this term is both gauge invariant and SL2R invariant. So that's a nice thing to check. And also the couplings involving the work volume gauge field in the Einstein frame have also the same property. And in the Einstein frame, they look they combine into something nice like this. So we have f plus I dual f dm tau times this, the same combination a plus ib. So again, a gauge transformation amounts to here, adding a phase here. And in the SL2R transformation, we can see that this is invariant under tau going to tau plus 1 because it involves only the derivative of the axiom. And when tau goes to minus 1 over tau, the way to show that this is self-dual is the same as Cyber-Witten's proof of S-duality in n equals 2. So we introduce a Lagrange multiplier field, AD, and we add a term like this. And we integrate out F. And what happens is very similar to what happens in the regular n equals 2 supersymmetric Lagrangian. The bosonic term, which is like this, goes to the same thing where f is replaced by fd, and tau is replaced to minus 1 over tau. And this term here, what happens is that it goes to this term where f is replaced by fd, and dm tau into the phi over 2 is replaced by dm tau over tau into the phi over 2. But this is just what we will get if tau goes to 1 over tau, if tau goes to minus 1 over tau, dm tau prime into the phi prime over 2 is equal to this times this phase. So again, by doing this transformation and going to this dual field strength, we pick up a phase. And in this case, any one of these two phases can be removed by a duality rotation on the word volume field strength. So by a rotation like this, we add a phase and we can remove any these two phases. So to second order in the fermions and to first order in the field strength, we prove that the action is gauge invariant and a SL2R self-dual. So I think that's it. Any questions so far?
Is it true that there were mistakes in the supergravity literature that you had to identify?
There's a paper that has the supersymmetry transformation in the string frame, which I use because it's much nicer to work in the string frame than with the conventions that are in Schwarz's paper, and it has some one two somewhere that took me a while to. No, the Schwarz paper, not the other paper. The other paper. It's by Kalosh, Horting, and some two other people. So the fermions coupled to this combination, star C3, dual, this is the dual, sorry, this is the dual in six dimensions, right? Dual C3 minus I C3. And this combination arises a lot in the supergravity solutions. Because we will see, for example, if we have a background of the Ward form, like this, and a five-form field strength of the form that we have, but here, for this to be a solution of the equation of motion, this F has to be 1 over the Ward factor. And if the dilaton is constant, and now to this background we add three-form flux, the equation of motion for the three-form flux, which is something like this, equal to, this is proportional to the derivative of tau, which is 0 in this case. So this equation can be written as this. So we can see that an obvious solution to this equation is C3 to be imaginary self-dual. And to all solutions that are of this form, the D3 brain doesn't couple to those solutions. Or we can also have solutions where this is not 0, but it's proportional to C times some closed form. And we will see examples of both of them. But with respect to the complex structure, she has a 3-0 piece, a 2-1 piece, a 1-2 piece, and a 0-3 piece. The 3-0 piece, she I, jk, is such that its dual is equal to minus I itself. So this is supposed to be an I, and means that the D3 brain sees this part, the 3-0 piece of the three-form flux. The 2-1 piece, we can combine them into some symmetric and antisymmetric combinations. So we contract two of their indices with an epsilon tensor, and we symmetrize on A and J, or we antisymmetrize. If we symmetrize, then, and we take the dual here, The dual of this is equal to I itself, so the D3 brain doesn't see this symmetrized part of the 2-1 piece. The anti-symmetrized, which is equal to, if this is 1 and 2, this is equal to G3LL. This is, there's a minus sign, so it's minus imaginary self-dual. So the D3 brain sees this piece. And with the 1-2 piece, it's the other way about. The D3 brain sees the symmetric part, and it doesn't see the anti-symmetric part. And the 0-3 piece is imaginary self-dual, so the D3 brain doesn't couple to this piece. So there, in this combination, there are only three pieces that survive. We'll see solutions where these pieces are zero and are not zero. So I started with showing this paper, and those are two solutions, exact solutions to the supersymmetry equations and to the equation of motion, where, well, G3 is imaginary self-dual and is closed, so that you have obeys Bianchi identity. The metric on the sixth dimension is a Ricci flat metric on the manifold. So this means that there is only one equation that we have to solve, that the Laplacian of C has to be proportional to the density of D3 brain plus some second order G times G, something like that. And for this solution, the D3 brain doesn't couple to this solution. But anyway, this solution can be supersymmetric just by setting. So when we ask G3 to be imaginary self-dual, these are the three pieces that survive, are exactly the opposite to the ones that the D3 brain sees. And if we set this 2 to 0, we get solutions with n equal 1 supersymmetry. And I will say, in two transparencies later, to what solutions that we know of we heard in the literature, this correspond to. And we also work out some perturbative first order solution where the metric is flat to first order, and we have three-form flux to first order. And this three-form flux is not, in principle, is not imaginary self-dual. And to preserve n equals one supersymmetry, instead of working with the equation of motion, we work with the supersymmetry equation. And to preserve n equals one supersymmetry, these are the two equations that we have to obey. And I just say this because it will be important later. The Di Latino equation, the supersymmetry transformation of the Di Latino being zero, the supersymmetry transformation of the Di Latino is something like this. And if we want to preserve n equals one supersymmetry, we can use an SO6 rotation to choose epsilon such that it's annihilated by gamma I bar. If gamma I bar annihilates epsilon, this means that these two pieces of the three-form flux have to be zero. And this is usually referred to as G is primitive. So the 3-0 piece and the primitive, the 3-0 piece and this anti-symmetric 2-1 piece have to be zero. And this solution also allows for holomorphic tau, for some holomorphic tau. Because if we have gamma I bar annihilates epsilon, then gamma I annihilates epsilon star, so we can have some holomorphic derivative of the dilaton. So doing this and also making this equal to zero, we have that all surviving components can be written in terms of one holomorphic function. And we showed in this paper that this holomorphic function is the superpotential that breaks n equals 4 into n equals 1 in the dual gauge theory. So if we have some superpotential, the breaking n equals 4 supersymmetry, through this analysis, we can get what the dual three-form flux is. And we get that the 3-0 piece, as we say here, is equal to 0. This is equal to 0. These are two pieces that the D3 brain sees. This piece is free. Well, it's constrained after by the equation of motion, but we don't care because the D3 brain doesn't see that. The symmetric combination of 1-2 pieces is proportional to the work factor times 2 derivative of the superpotential. And these two pieces are determined by the superpotential and the work factor. But again, we don't care about this because the D3 brain doesn't see this. So the D3 brain in this perturbative first order solution couples to this derivative of the superpotential. And I'll show you how that is seen from the D3 brain gauge theory. And we can have configurations with non-constant dilaton, where we have these three brains in the 0, 1, 2, 3, and these seven brains in the 0, 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7. And so they have this dilaton that is not constant, and it depends on the orthogonal coordinates of the seven brain. The metric is like this. The five-form flux is as before. This solution preserves n equals 2 supersymmetry, but we can turn on three-form flux from these solutions. And n equals 1 supersymmetry is preserved if she is 2-1 and primitive. So this means that in this setup, she has to obey the imaginary self-duality condition, so the brain doesn't couple to this solution. Only the word volume field strength will couple to the derivative of the dilaton axion. And Giddings, Katru, and Polchinski showed in a general case, if we have, in a general compact case, if we have a warp metric, the five-form flux as before, a dilaton that depends on the orthogonal coordinate, G-form flux, and a BPS condition that is something like this, the trace in the directions, in the 0, 1, 2, 3 directions, minus the orthogonal trace, greater or equal to the tension, times the D3 charge density of the source. If this inequality is in fact saturated, so if this is equal, the equation of motion are satisfied if G3 is imaginary self-dual. And then, well, they have some conditions for n equals 1 supersymmetry. And this inequality is saturated by D3 brains, O3 planes, D5 brains wrap on collapse cycles, and D7 brains wrap on K3. So the word volume fields don't couple to all these kind of solutions.
These are like no-scale models again. Supersymmetry is broken, but the brain doesn't see it. So mm-hmm. These things keep coming up in various examples.
Yeah, here I say what the examples are that we know. So I talked about the D3 brain background plus three-form flux perturbation, and the D3 brain couples to this combination. And these are the solution by Polchinski and Strassler, where the D3 brain polarize into D5 brains, fall into this class of solutions. So in those solutions, the D3 brains is this part. In solutions, these exact solutions where we have a D3 brain plus three-form flux, the D3 brain doesn't couple to it. And if the manifold, the orthogonal manifold, is a conifold, these are the solutions by Klebanov and Seidling. If it's a deformed conifold, these are the solutions by Klebanov and Strassler. And in this case, this corresponds to D5 brains wrap and collapse to cycles at the conifold singularity. So in these solutions, the D3 brain doesn't see, in fact, the five brains. And in all compact solutions that have D3 brains, all three planes, D5 brains wrap on collapse cycles, D7 brains wrap on K3, the D3 brain doesn't couple to this background. So most of the solutions that we know of are the D3 are transparent to the D3 brain. And now we want to see this from the point of view of the gauge theory and the D3 brain. So for that, we split the word volume spinor, that is in the 16 bar, into some SO3,1 component times some SO6 component. So from the point of view of 3+1 dimensional theory, there are four fermions, one gauge-ino and three fermions in the chiral multiplet. So if we take, for example, this, the 2-4 bar, the gauge-ino is formed with a spinor in six dimensions such that it's annihilated by all gamma I bar. And the chiral fermions is formed with a spinor in six dimensions that is equal to this spinor raised by where two of the components are raised. So if we raise it 2 or 3, we can say that this is lambda 1. And so we said that from this combination, only these pieces survive the 3-0, the symmetric 2-1, and the, this is, sorry, the symmetric, in fact, this is the symmetric 1-2, and this is the anti-symmetric 2-1. And if we write this, so we'll get gamma ijk times cijk, etc. And for example, cijk has 3 gamma I indices, so we will see that it annihilates, so we see that it annihilates these fermions, but it doesn't annihilate the gauge-ino. So this term will give us a math term for the Gay Genome. And so the Lagrangian, the Lagrangian that we have, the coupling, this Lagrangian written in terms of where the fermions on the D3 brain looks like this. So the Gay Genome mass is proportional to the 3-0 piece of the shift flux. The chiral fermions mass matrix is proportional to the symmetrized 1-2 piece. And the chiral fermion Gay Genome interaction is proportional to the non-primitive 2-1 piece. And this, in fact, fits nicely with low energy effective n equals 1 supersymmetric Lagrangians. In low energy effective n equals 1 supersymmetric Lagrangians, we have mass terms given by this, mass term for the Gay Genome chiral fermion interaction given by this, and mass terms for the chiral fermions given by this, for example. So the Gay Genome mass is given by this. So a Bakken expectation value of F will give a Gay Genome mass, and in our case, a Bakken expectation value of the 3-0 piece of G-form flux gives a Gay Genome mass. And here we have d tau d phi, and we saw from the Diratino equation that if tau is holomorphic, this is supersymmetric if this 3-0 form piece, this 3-0 piece is equal to zero. So just as the Bakken expectation value of F breaks supersymmetry in this case, the Bakken expectation value of GIJK breaks supersymmetry in our case. And the Gay Genome chiral fermion interaction is proportional to this. And in our case, it's proportional to the non-primitive 2-1 piece. And so again, from the Diratino equation, this piece has to be zero if the Diraton is holomorphic. So this breaking by D, by Bakken expectation value of D, is equivalent to this breaking by the non-primitive 2-1 piece. And the last thing is that the chiral fermion mass matrices in the Lagrangians is proportional to the second derivative of the superpotential. And in our case, it's proportional to this symmetric combination. And we saw that for this D3 brain background plus 3-form flux perturbation, this was exactly C times the second derivative of the superpotential with respect to phi I, phi j. So these two fit very nicely, and I was happy with that result. And if we turn on some word volume gauge field, this in terms of this, the fermions, the Gay Genome and the chiral fermions looks like this. So they are electric and magnetic dipole moments where the holomorphic derivative of tau couples to, gives a transition moment between the Gay Genome and one of the chiral fermions, and the anti-holomorphic derivative gives a transition moment between two chiral fermions. And this term also fits nicely with n equals 1 supersymmetry. In n equals 1 supersymmetric Lagrangians, we have this. And well, this term will break supersymmetry, anti-holomorphic. So, no questions, I finish early. So, in summary, we found the couplings between the word volume fermions and a supergravity background to second order in the fermions and to first order in F. The couplings are of this form, where we have this combination that couples directly to the word volume fields, and the derivative of the Diraton action that couples through the field strength to the fermions. We show that this action is gauge invariant, where this gauge is the gauge to fix kappa symmetry, and is a L2R self-dual. We show that this combination is closely related to the equation of motion, and most of the solutions that we know of, this combination is zero. And we interpreted these results in terms of gauge theory and the D3 brain, and we saw that the Gay Genome mass is given by the 3-0 piece of the 3-form flux. The chiral fermion Gay Genome interaction is given by this piece. The chiral fermion mass matrix is given by this. And there are transition electric and magnetic dipole moments. And all this fits nicely with n equals 1 supersymmetric Lagrangian. So now that we have this, we can redo the calculation of from G-duality and get the result for any DP brain. And in fact, now we can change and do more general setups because this setup was particular to, because we were interested in that. But once we had the expansions or we know how to do the expansions, it's not difficult to get the result for the action for any deep brain. And the idea is to apply this to deep brain models, to any of the current deep brain models. But to do that, we will need a generalization to many deep brains. And that's not clear. I guess we will have to find it from just by guessing what the terms are, because the DBI action, not even in the bosonic case, is known for many deep brains, so less in the supersymmetrized case. But it would be nice to apply this to some deep brain model. Thank you.
So if I wanted a toy model where I lived on one deep brain, what does this tell me about physics of those models?
That you have a Geishino map, depending on which, if you have three-form flux, depending on which pieces of the three-form flux you can have Geishino masses, and you can have Carroll fermion masses.
Well, what about these dipole moments?
Well, these dipole moments, I mean, we have transition.
You call them transition, but I'm not sure what you're transiting from.
Well, it's a transition between one Carroll fermion and the other. So this is antisymmetric in gamma I, gamma j. So it's like a transition between one neutrino and another. This is what we have. If these chiral fermions are the neutrino in that model, then we will have something that expects a transition between an electron neutrino and some other neutrino. This is like a neutrino, yeah, transition. The neutrino mass is given by this, would be given by this term. And neutrino.
This F mu mu would be the electromagnetic
field? The electromagnetic field on the D3 brain, yeah. So
this would say that if I turn on a magnetic field, one neutrino can turn into another.
Right. Right.
Is that ruled out by anything? Sorry, experiment.
It's not ruled out, but it's the number has to be very small. But it's not.
Is that a problem?
It's not ruled out. Well, that's what we were trying to analyze. But the thing is, to make this the neutrino, so there has to be some SU2 coupling here by a Higgs field, and then the thing is going to be small anyway. Yeah, that's what we were trying to analyze, if these are in fact the neutrinos or what.
But if,
we
I
get
just,
any?
If I just guessed that I would get a term like this, where that F was the F of hypercharge, would that be a problem or not? Is there secretly some 1/4 bond mass or something?
Well, there is, yeah, because there is a, I think, right, because there is a Higgs, there should be some Higgs term here to make this SU2. Invariant some.
It's maybe dimension 5, because you've got lambda F, which is not too suppressed. But then because you need a factor of the Higgs field, which I guess must be hidden in partial k bar tau, right? The Higgs field must be in there.
Yeah.
It's really dimension 6. And that makes it pretty
small.
Pretty suppressed unless you stand on your head.
Okay, but even if it's dimension 5, it is 1/4 the string scale and not
Yeah, that's we have both the electric. Well, this will give the magnetic, and this will be the electric dipole moment. Yeah, so probably this will rule out the, as we were saying, this probably the dilaton has to be constant to make this work in some models if we want to plug in numbers. And
there are probably some large dimension models that are ruled out by this, but some models. Yeah. And there are dimension models that are explicit enough to really sort of apply this to yet. people there, like, so mm-hmm. they're all the same.
Yeah, but for the flat, for flat space, and yeah, I haven't seen. Huh? But you're talking about the supersymmetries or the?
Well, the bosonic one.
Yeah, the bosonic one, yes, and supersymmetries for the supersymmetries for flat space only, and it's already ugly how they find it. So I don't know, to extend that, to do the same thing in cured space, I'm not sure that it will work because it's doing iteratively by knowing what the Wesomino action is. So, and demanding kappa symmetry. Oh, if you know something, I'll be happy to.
I'm a bit confused because if this level is just the symmetric trace, the bosonic part is just the symmetric trace. And as far as mass term go, well, it's just like adding mass term in both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably to this order is not hard to guess.
Yeah, both of them.
But you might be right that it's not that hard. Yeah, it would be nice to have it to apply this to some models. I mean, these are the renormalizable terms, so to higher order, they're already non-renormalized. I mean, I don't know if you can get any physics. They're all suppressed. And I don't know if you can get any interesting physics from higher order terms. I would say not much.
One of the original reasons for thinking about this was Randall and Sundrum argued several years ago that there was this thing called anomaly-mediated supersymmetry breaking. That if supersymmetry was broken on one brain, and we lived on another brain, then the effect of supersymmetry breaking, as we would see in terms of the masses, the superparticles, and so on, would fit in a definite and universal pattern. And that seemed kind of neat, because it was a real prediction. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, as time has gone on, it seems like the assumptions they made were overly restrictive and you don't get any universal predictions. And you kind of see that here because as you list the different classes of solutions and they have different, some of them have vanishing. There are those solutions where the brain doesn't see the breaking, which is kind of like what they were saying. Mm-hmm. They were saying that classically you didn't see any breakings and then the breakings you did see were induced by loop effects in some universal way. So there may be some backgrounds for which their original phenomenology kind of holds. Like, although again, the original picture they had was much too, seems now much too naive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, exactly, this is something which during the Brain World program, there were sort of animated discussions about this between various people working on that. Unfortunately, it was universal, but it was universally wrong because it's kind of nice that you can falsify something because what you found was that these stellar leptons would have negative masses squared, and so the squarks and the sleptons would get vebs and great electromagnetism, which doesn't happen in nature. So it was kind of nice that you could actually simulate from string theory and prediction that was falsifiable. But again, unfortunately,
the load threshold is nice.
it's not clear now. It would be nice to take this and to really ask some of these detailed questions about, you know, real models, but.